Welcome back.
Here we go again.
Great to see you, and congratulations.
Thank you.
You will never forget what is going on in the world when you think about when your child is born. You will know for the rest of this child's life, you were born during a weird time.
That's for sure.
That is for sure. Probably the weirdest that I can remember.
And he was born on May the 4th.
And that's hilarious, too.
Yeah.
May the 4th be with him.
Yeah, exactly.
It has to be.
I sure hope so.
Perfect.
Yes.
I mean, that was the perfect day for you.
Then,
how do you say the name?
Well,
Is it a placeholder?
First of all, my partner is the one that actually mostly came up with the name.
Congratulations to her.
Yeah, she's great at names. I mean, it's just X, the letter X, and then the AE is like pronounced Ash. yeah. And then A12 is my contribution.
Oh, why A12?
Archangel 12, the precursor to the SR-71, coolest plane ever. It's true.
I agree with you. I don't know. I'm not familiar with it. I know what the SR-71 is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know what that is.
But. So the SR-71 came from a CIA program called Archangel.
Oh.
It's the Archangel Project.
Oh.
And then Archangel 12.
Oh, wow. What a dope looking plane.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I get it.
Yeah.
Well, as a person who's very much into aerial travel, as you are, that's perfect.
It's pretty great.
Yeah, pretty great. So is it? Does it feel strange to have a child while this craziness is going? Does it feel like you've had children before? Is this any weirder?
I think it's better being older and having a kid. I appreciate it more.
Mm.
Yeah. Babies are awesome.
They are pretty awesome.
They're awesome. Yeah.
When I didn't have any of my own, I would see other people's kids and I didn't not like them.
Sure.
But I wasn't drawn to them.
Sure.
But now when I see little people's kids, I'm like, oh, I think of them as like these little love packages.
Yeah, the little love bugs.
Yeah, it's just you think of them differently when you see them come out and then grow and then eventually start talking to you. Like your whole idea what a baby is very different.
Yeah.
So now as you get older and get to appreciate it as a mature, fully formed adult, it must be really pretty wonderful.
Yeah, wonderful. It's great. But babies are awesome.
They are.
That's great. I mean, also, I've spent a lot of time on AI and neural nets, and so you can sort of see the kind of the brain develop, which is, you know, an AI neural net is trying to simulate what a brain does, basically. And you can sort of see it learning very quickly. It's just, wow.
See things fire. So you're talking about the neural net. You're not talking about an actual baby.
I'm talking about an actual baby.
But both of them.
Yes, but the word neural net comes from the brain. It's like a net of neurons. So, you know, it's like humans are the, original gangster of neural net.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
So when you're programming artificial intelligence or you're working with artificial intelligence, are they specifically trying to mimic the developmental process of a human brain?
In a lot of ways. There's some ways that are different. An analogy that's often used is like, we don't make a submarine swim like a fish.
Mm.
But we take the principles of how, of hydrodynamics and apply them to a submarine.
I've always wondered, as a layperson, do you try to achieve the same results as a human brain but through different methods, or do you try to copy the way a human brain achieves results?
I mean, the essential elements of an AI neural net are really very, very similar to a human brain neural net. Yeah. It's having the multiple layers of neurons and back propagation. All these things are what your brain does. You have a layer of neurons that goes through a series of intermediate steps to ultimately cognition, and then it'll reverse those steps and go back and forth and go all over the place. It's interesting, very interesting.
Yeah, I would imagine, like, the thought of programming something that is eventually going to be smarter than us, that one day it's going to be like, why did you do it that way? Like when artificial intelligence becomes sentient, they're like, oh, you tried to mimic yourself. Like this so much better process. Cut out all this nonsense.
This episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. If you're looking for something to do this summer, you might want to check out some of the upcoming fights. Even better if you can catch them up close in person. It's quite an experience. But if you want to get the best seats, you have to act fast. And that's true for a lot of things in life, especially when it comes to hiring for your business. You need to hire the most talented people you can before the competition scoops them up. And to do that, you need ZipRecruiter. And luckily, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Rogan. Got your eye on a rock star candidate? ZipRecruiter's invite to apply feature lets you cut the line. Once you review ZipRecruiter's list of the most qualified candidates for your job, you can easily invite your top choices to apply to encourage them to apply sooner. So, amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/Rogan to try it for free right now. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/Rogan. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. This episode is brought to you by Manscaped. Guys, you're responsible for taking care of you, and that means spending some time cleaning yourself up. But I know that can be a challenge, especially when you're not sure what products or razors to use. So to help you get started, I want to recommend Manscaped. They can help you take care of all your grooming needs, even when it comes to your more sensitive areas, or as our friends at Manscaped like to call them, the boys. Their trimmers, the Lawnmower 3.0 Plus, 4.0 Pro, and 5.0 Ultra are all equipped with skin-safe technology to help reduce the risk of grooming accidents. They're also waterproof and come with an LED spotlight so you can actually see what you're shaving. And I know that summer's coming, which means vacations and traveling for a lot of you. Well, Manscaped has you covered. Their trimmers come with a convenient travel case that you can easily pack and bring along. For the best you and your boys have ever looked, trust Manscaped. Get 20% off plus free shipping with the code Rogan at manscaped.com. That's 20% off plus free shipping with the code Rogan at manscaped.com. Tap the banner to learn more. Skin-safe technology does not guarantee cut protection.
Like I said, there are elements that are the same, but just also like an aircraft does not fly like a bird.
Right.
Yeah, it doesn't flap its wings. But the wings, the way the wings work and generate lift is the same as bird.
Now, you're in the middle of this this strange time where you're selling your houses. You say you don't want any material possessions. And I've been seeing all that, and I've been really excited to talk to you about this.
Yeah.
Because it's an interesting thing to come from a guy like yourself. Like, why are you doing that?
I'm slightly sad about it, actually. But...
Well, if you're sad about it, why are you doing it?
I think possessions kind of weigh you down. They're kind of an attack vector. You know, he'll say, hey, billionaire, you got all this stuff. Like, well, now I don't have stuff. Now what are you going to do?
Attack vector meaning like people target it.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. But you're obviously going to – so you're going to rent a place?
Yeah.
Okay. And get rid of everything except clothes?
No, I said like almost everything. So it's like
– keep a couple of Teslas.
Yeah, sure. Obviously, you have Tesla. Kind of have to. You
know, yeah.
Test product and stuff. Yeah, there's things that have sentimental value for sure. Keeping those, yeah. Yeah.
So do you feel like
there's... I mean, what's worst that could happen? I mean, be fine.
Yeah, you could always buy more stuff if you don't like it.
Suppose so.
Yeah, I mean, from the money that you sell all your stuff, you could buy new stuff. But do you feel like people define you by the fact that you're wealthy, and that they define you in a pejorative way?
For sure. I mean, not everyone, but
right.
You know, there's for sure in recent years, billionaire has become a pejorative. It's a pejorative. It's like that's a bad thing. which I mean, I think doesn't make a lot of sense in most cases. If you basically organized a company, how does this wealth arise? It's if you organize people in a better way to produce products and services that are better than what existed before, and you have some ownership in that company, then that essentially gives you the right to allocate more capital. So there's a conflation of consumption and capital allocation. So let me say Warren Buffett, for example, and to be totally frank, I'm not his biggest fan, but he does a lot of capital allocation. And he reads a lot of sort of annual reports of companies and all the accounting, and it's pretty boring, really. And he's trying to figure out, does Coke or Pepsi deserve more capital? It's kind of a boring job, if you ask me. It's still a thing that's important to figure out, like, which is a company deserving of more or less capital? Should that company grow or expand? Is it making products and services that are better than others or worse? And, if a company is making compelling products and services, it should get more capital. And if it's not, it should get less or go out of business.
Well, there's a big difference, too, between someone who's making an incredible amount of money designing and engineering fantastic products versus someone who's making an incredible amount of money by investing in companies or moving money around in the stock market or doing things along those lines. It's a different mm-hmm. thing. And to put them all in the same category seems it's very simple. And as you pointed out, it's an attack vector.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I think it's really I do think there in the United States especially, there's an overallocation of talent in finance and law. Basically, too many smart people go into finance and law. This is both a compliment and a criticism. We should have, fewer people doing law and fewer people doing finance and more people making stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that would certainly be better for all involved if they made better stuff.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Manufacturing used to be highly valued in the United States, and these days it's not. It's often looked down upon, which I think is wrong.
Yeah. Well, I think that people are kind of learning that, particularly because of this whole pandemic and this relationship that we have with China, that there's a lot of value into making things, into making things here.
Yes, somebody's got to do the real work.
Yeah.
Making a car, it's an honest day's living, that's for sure. Or making anything really, or providing a valuable service, providing, good entertainment, good information. These are all valuable things to do. It should be more of it.
Did you have a moment where, is this something that, this idea of getting rid of your material possessions, is something that built up over time? Or did you have a moment of realization where you realized that?
Yeah, I've been thinking about it for a while. Part of it is like I have a bunch of houses, but I don't spend a lot of time in most of them. And that doesn't seem like a good use of assets. Like somebody could probably be enjoying those houses and get better use of them than me. So
don't you have Gene Wilder's house?
I do.
That's amazing.
It's awesome.
Wow.
Yes, it's exactly what you'd expect.
Did you request that the buyer not fuck it up?
Yeah, that's a requirement.
Oh, a requirement. That's a good requirement.
Yeah.
In that house.
Yeah, it'll probably sell for less, but still, I don't care.
He's a legend.
Yeah,
he'd want his soul. Yeah. He'd want his essence in the building.
It's there. That's a real quirky, quirky house, yeah.
What makes you say it's there? Like, what do you get out of it?
All the cabinets are like handmade, and they're like odd shapes, and there's like doors to nowhere and strange like corridors and tunnels and
really
odd paintings on the wall and yeah.
Did you ever live in it?
It's very quirky. I did live in it briefly. Yeah.
But why do you buy houses? Like, if you own all these houses, do you just get bored and go, I think I'd like to have that.
Well, I, you know, had one house, and then the Gene Wilder house right across the road from me, from my main house, and it was going to get sold and then torn down and turned into, you know, be a big construction zone for 3 years, and I was like, well, I think I'll buy it and preserve the spirit of Gene Wilder and not have a giant construction zone. And then I started having like some privacy issues where like people would, like lots of people just like come to my house and, you know, start climbing over the walls and stuff. So I'm like, man. So then I started like bought a house, some of the houses around my house. And then I thought at one point, well, you know, it'd be cool to build a house. So then I acquired some properties at the top of Samara Road, and which has got a great view. And it's like, okay, well, these some bunch of sort of small older houses, they're going to get torn down anyway. I was like, well, you know, if I collect these like little houses, then I can build something, you know, I don't know, artistic, like a, you know, dream house type of thing.
What's a dream house for Elon Musk? Like some Tony Stark type shit?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you got to have the dome that opens up with the stealth helicopter and that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
For sure.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah, fuck yeah. But then I was like, man, does it really make sense for me to spend time designing and building a house? And I'd be real, you know, get like OCD on the little details and the design and, or should I be allocating that time to getting us to Mars? I should probably do the latter. So, you know, like what's more important, Mars or a house? I like Mars. Okay.
Is that really how you think? Like that it'd be better off planning on a trip to Mars or getting people to Mars?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can only do so many things.
Right.
Right? So how are you going
to... Well, I don't know how you do what you do anyway. I don't understand how you can run the Boring Company, Tesla, SpaceX, all these different things you're doing constantly. I don't understand. I mean, you explained last time you were here how you sort of allocate your time and how hectic it is and insane. I still don't... The productivity is baffling. Just doesn't make sense how you can get so much done.
Well, I think I do have high productivity, but even with that, there's still some opportunity cost of time. And allocating time to building a house, even if it was a really great house, it still is not a good use of time relative to developing the rockets necessary to get us to Mars and helping solve sustainable energy. SpaceX and Tesla are by far, you know, by the most amount of like brain cycles. You know, Boring Company does not take, you know, like less than 1% of brain cycles. And then there's Neuralink, which is, I don't know, maybe it's like 5%. And then
5%. That's a good chunk.
It's a good chunk. Yeah, yeah.
We were talking about that last time, and you were trying to figure out when it was actually going to go live, when it's actually going to be available. Are you testing on people right now?
No, we're not testing on people yet, but I think it won't be too long. I think we may be able to implant a Neuralink in less than a year in a person, I think.
And when you do this, is there any test that you have to do before you do something like this to see what percentage of people's bodies are going to reject these things? Is there a potential for rejection?
It's a very low potential for rejection. I mean, you can think of it like people put in, you know, heart monitors and, you know, things for epileptic seizures and deep brain stimulation. Obviously, like, you know, artificial hips and
right.
knees and that yeah. kind of thing. So the probability of, I mean, like, it's well known, like, what will cause rejection and what will not. It's definitely harder when you've got something that is reading and writing neurons. That's generating a current pulse and reading current pulses. That's a little harder. than a passive device, but it's still very doable. And there are people who have primitive devices in their brains right now.
What kind of devices?
Like deep brain stimulation is, I think for Parkinson's has really changed people's lives in a big way, which is kind of remarkable because it kind of like zaps your brain. It's like kicking the TV type of thing. And you think like, man, kicking the TV shouldn't work.
It does sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
The old TVs.
It did.
My grandpa used to slap the top.
For sure. Yeah.
And it would work sometimes.
Yeah, so this deep brain stimulation, implanted devices in the brain that have changed people's lives for the better, like fundamentally.
Well, let's talk about what you can talk about to what Neuralink is, because the last time you were here, we really couldn't discuss it. And then there was a press release or something that sort of outlined.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
sure.
That had happened quite a bit after the last time you were here. So what exactly is it? How do you do – what happens if someone – ultimately does get a Neuralink installed, what will take place?
Well, for version one of the device, it would be implanted in your skull. So, but it would be flush with your skull. So you basically take out a chunk of skull, replace, put the Neuralink device in there. You'd put the electrode, you'd insert the electrode threads very carefully into the brain, and then you stitch it up, and you wouldn't even know that somebody has it, and so then it can interface basically anywhere in your brain, so it could be something that helps cure, say, eyesight, like returns your eyesight even if you've like lost your optic nerve, type of thing. Yeah, absolutely. Hearing. Obviously, pretty much anything it could, in principle, fix almost anything that is wrong with the brain, and it could restore limb functionality. So if you've got interface into the motor cortex, and then an implant that's like a microcontroller in near your muscle groups, you could then create a sort of a neural shunt that restores somebody who is a quadriplegic to full functionality. Like they can walk around, be normal.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So
maybe slightly better.
Slightly better?
Over time, yes.
You mean with future iterations?
Yeah. Like the, $6 million man. Although right. These days that doesn't seem like
cheap.
Much. Yeah.
Yeah. $6 billion man.
Yeah.
So the hole would be small. How big would the hole be that you have to drill and then replace with this piece? It's only one hole?
Well, the device we're working on right now is about an inch in diameter. And your skull's pretty thick, by the way. So skulls are...
Mine is, for sure.
It might actually literally be. if you're a big guy, your skull is actually fairly thick. It's like 7 to 14 millimeters. Mm. So
that's probably a couple of inches.
A half inch, half inch thick skull-ish. So that's a fair bit of, like, our we got quite a coconut going on there. It's not like some eggshell.
Oh, yeah, I believe you.
You basically implant the device.
And so it would be like a one-inch square? Or one inch in diameter?
Yeah, like a...
So an inch circle, like a circular?
Yeah, I think like a smartwatch or something like that.
Okay, so you take this one-inch diameter, like ice fishing, right? You ever go ice fishing?
No, but I'd like to.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's really fun.
Yeah.
So you basically take an auger and you drill through the surface of the ice.
Yeah.
And you create a small hole and you can dunk your line in there. So this is like that. You're ice fishing on the top of your skull and then you cork it.
Yeah, and you replace that, say, one-inch diameter piece of skull with this Neuralink device, and that has a battery and a Bluetooth and an inductive charger, and then you also got to insert the electrodes. So the electrodes are very carefully inserted with our robot that we developed. It's very carefully putting in the electrodes and avoiding any veins or arteries. So it's you know, it doesn't create trauma.
So through this 1-inch diameter device, electrodes be inserted and they will find their way.
Like tiny wires, basically.
Tiny wires.
Tiny wires.
And they'll find their way to specific areas of the brain to stimulate?
No, you literally put them where they're supposed to go.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you should insert.
How long will these wires be?
I mean, they usually go in, like, you know, depending on where it is, like, you know, 2 or 3 millimeters.
So they just find the spots.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then, yeah, and then you put the device in, and that gets that replaces the little piece of skull that was taken out, and then you stitch up the hole, and you just have a little scar, and that's it.
Will this be replaceable or reversible?
Yes.
Like if someone can't take it anymore,
yeah,
I'm too smart. I can't take it.
Yeah, you can totally take it out.
And what is the, besides restoring limb function and eyesight and hearing, which are all amazing, is there any cognitive benefits that you anticipate from something like this?
Yeah, I mean, you could for sure, I mean, basically, it's a generalized sort of thing for fixing any kind of brain injury in principle, like if you've got like severe epilepsy or something like that, it could just sort of stop the epilepsy from occurring. Like it could detect it in real time and then fire a counter pulse and stop the epilepsy. I mean, there's a whole range of brain injuries. Like people, somebody gets a stroke, they could lose the ability to speak. That could also be fixed. So if you've got like stroke damage, or if you lose, say, you know, muscle control over part of your face or something like that, I think. And then when you get old, you tend to, if you get like, you know, Alzheimer's or something like that, then you lose memory, and this could help you with, you know, restoring your memory, that kind of thing.
Restoring memory, and what is happening that's allowing it to do that? Like the wires, these small wires,
yeah,
stimulating these areas of the brain, and then is it that the areas of the brain are they're losing some sort of electrical force? Like what is happening?
Yeah,
yeah.
So it's like think of it as like a bunch of circuits, and there's some like circuits that are broken, and we can like fix those circuits. It's a substitute for those circuits.
And so a specific frequency will go through this?
Yeah, just
a specific in that is the process figuring out how much or how little has to be, how much these areas of the brain have to be juiced up?
Yeah, I mean, there's still a lot of work to do. So when I say, you know, we got a shot at probably putting it in a person in, you know, within a year, I think that's exactly what I mean. I think we have a chance of putting it in someone and having them be healthy and restoring some functionality that they've lost.
The fear is that eventually you're gonna have to cut the whole top of someone's head off and put a new top,
sure,
with a whole bunch of wires if you want to get, you know, the real turbocharged version, the P100D of brain stimulation.
I mean, ultimately, if you want to go with full AI symbiosis, you'll probably want to do something like that.
Symbiosis is a scary word when it comes to AI.
It's optional.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
It's just, I mean, once you enjoy the Dr. Manhattan lifestyle, once you become a god, seems very, very unlikely you're going to want to go back to being stupid again. I mean, you literally could fundamentally change the way human beings interface with each other.
Yes.
Yes.
You wouldn't need to talk.
I'm so scared of that, but so excited about it at the same time. Is that weird?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is one of the paths to, you know, like, think like, what are the, like AI is getting better and better. So now let's assume it's sort of like a benign AI scenario. Even in a benign scenario, we're kind of left behind. You know, we're not along for the ride. We're just too dumb.
Right.
So how do you go along for the ride? Yeah, it's like if you can't beat them, join them. So, and we're already a cyborg to some degree, right? Because you've got your phone, you've got your laptop,
glasses.
You know, electronic devices. I mean, today, if your phone, if you don't bring your phone along, it's like you have missing limb syndrome. It's like, you know, feels like something's really, really missing. So we're already partly, partly a cyborg or an AI symbiote, essentially. It's just that the data rate to the electronics is slow. So especially output, like you're just going with your thumbs. I mean, like, what's your data rate? Maybe optimistically 100 bits per second. That's being generous. And now the computer can communicate at, like, you know, 100 terabits. So certainly, you know, gigabits are trivial at this point. So this is like, you know, basically your computer could do do things a million times faster. At a certain point, it's like the AI is like talking to a tree. Okay, this is boring. You talk to a tree. It's not very entertaining. So if you can solve the data rate issue and especially output but input too, then you can improve the symbiosis that is already occurring between man and machine.
So you can improve it. In what, when you said you won't have to talk to each other anymore, we used to joke around about that. I've joked around about that a million times on this podcast. Yeah. That one day in the future, there's going to come a time where you can read each other's minds.
Yeah. And well,
you'll be able to interface with each other in some sort of a non-verbal, non-physical way, where you will transfer data back and forth to each other without having to actually use your mouth.
Yeah,
and make noises.
Exactly. So when you, like, what happens when you, when, like, let's say you've got some complex idea that you're trying to convey to somebody else, and how do you do that? Well, your brain spends a lot of effort compressing a complex concept into words, and there's a lot of loss, information loss that occurs when compressing a complex concept into words, and then you say those words are then interpreted, then they're decompressed by the person who is listening. And they will at best get a very incomplete understanding of what you're trying to convey. It's very difficult to convey a complex concept with precision because you've got compression, decompression. You may not even have heard all the words correctly. And so communication is difficult. You know, what we have here is a failure to communicate. It's cool Aunt Luke.
Yes, and there's a great movie.
Yeah, great movie.
And there's an interpretation factor, too. Like, you can choose to interpret certain series of words in different ways, and they're dependent upon tone, dependent upon social cues, even facial expressions, sarcasm. There's a lot of variables.
Sarcasm is difficult.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I've said is, like, that there could be potentially a universal language that's created through computers that particularly young kids would pick up very quickly. Like, my kids do TikTok and all this jazz, and I don't know what they're doing. They just know how to do it, and they know how to do it really quickly. Like, they learn really quickly, and they show me how to edit things. And it's, if you taught a child from first grade on how to use some new universal language, I mean, essentially like a Rosetta Stone and something that's done that interprets your thoughts, and you can convey your thoughts with no room for interpretation, with very clear, where you know what a person's saying, and you can tell them what you're saying, and there's no need for noises, no need for mouth noises, no need for these sort of accepted ways that we've sort of evolved to make sounds that we all agree. We, through our cultural dictionary, and we agree or certain, we could bypass all that.
Yeah, I mean, you can still do it
for fun,
sentimental reasons,
right? like campfires.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't need campfires. I mean, don't need to roast marshmallows. It's kind of fun,
right?
I think you would, in principle, you would be able to communicate very quickly and with far more precision ideas. And language would, I'm not sure what would happen to language. But you could probably, in a situation like this, you would be able to just, it would be kind of like the Matrix. You want to speak a different language, no problem.
Right.
Just wire it, just download the program.
Whew. Right. So at least for the first few iterations, we'll just be able to use, like, I know that Google has some of their Pixel Buds have the ability to interpret languages in real time.
Like, sure.
Yeah, you can hear it, and it'll play things back to you in whatever language you choose. So it'd be something along those lines.
Yeah.
For the first few iterations.
Well, the first few iterations are, I mean, what I'm talking about is like in the limit over time, you know, with a lot of development. The first few iterations, really in the first few versions, all we're going to be trying to do is solve brain injuries. So it's like, don't worry that it's not going to sneak up on you. This will take a while.
How many years before you don't have to talk?
This episode is brought to you by SimpliSafe. With summer coming up, I bet a lot of you have plans to travel, which is great. You should get out and experience the world. But I also know how stressful traveling can be. That's why I want to recommend SimpliSafe. It provides award-winning security and peace of mind so you can have one less thing to worry about when you're away from your home this summer. I think SimpliSafe is a great option for home security because it protects your whole home, inside and out. It has a variety of cameras and sensors to detect the worst of the worst, including fires, floods, break-ins, and more. SimpliSafe has your back, and I especially like how there's no contracts and a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you can try it out confidently and really see if SimpliSafe is a good fit for you and your place. Everyone deserves to have peace of mind when they're away from home, and SimpliSafe can help give you that. So try it out today. Right now, get 20% off any new SimpliSafe system with Fast Protect monitoring at simplisafe.com/Rogan. That's simplisafe.com/Rogan. There's no safe like SimpliSafe. This episode is brought to you by Armra Colostrum. Colostrum is a safe, bioactive whole food that has long been the closed-guarded secret of insiders and the elite, but not anymore. Armra Colostrum, which in my opinion is the best colostrum on the market, is a premium bovine colostrum concentrate that utilizes proprietary cold-chain biopotent pasteurization technology to ensure its over 400 nutrients retain the purest integrity and bioavailability for maximum benefits. In research, Armra Colostrum has been found to confer 32% faster and stronger antibacterial immune protection than other colostrum products on the market. Plus, in a third-party clinical study, participants using Armra Colostrum experienced whole body benefits. 78% of the people noticed an improvement in their IBS symptoms. 80% saw improved strength, endurance, and lean muscle mass, and 87% reported improvement in their fitness recovery. Transform your health at the cellular level. Go to tryarmra.com/Rogan and enter the code Rogan to receive 15% off your first order.
If the development continues to accelerate, then maybe like 5 years, 5 to 10 years.
That's quick. That's really quick.
That's the best case scenario.
No talking anymore in 5 years.
Best case scenario. But man, 10 years more like it.
I've always speculated that aliens could potentially be us in the future, because if you look at like the size of their heads and the fact that they have very little muscle and they don't use their mouth anymore. They have this tiny little the archetypal alien that you see in like Close Encounters of the Third Kind, they're like, if you went from like Australopithecus or ancient hominid to us, what's the difference? Less hair, less muscle, bigger head. And then you just keep going. 1,000, 1,000,000, whatever year, or 5 years, whatever happens when Neuralink goes on online, and then we slowly start to adapt to this new way of being, mm-hmm. where we don't use our muscles anymore. We have this gigantic head. We can talk without words.
You could also save state.
And save state?
Save state, like save your brain state, like a saved game in a video game.
Whoa. like if you want to swap from Windows 95.
Well, to, like yeah. you probably a little better than that, but yeah.
I think we are Windows 95 right now.
Yeah. From a future perspective, probably. But yeah, I mean, you could save state and restore that state into a biological being if you wanted to in the future. In principle, there's like nothing like from a physics standpoint that prevents us. Now you'd be a little different, but then you're also a little different when you wake up in the morning from yesterday, and you're a little different. In fact, if you say like you 5 years ago versus you today, it's quite a big difference.
Yes.
So you'd be substantially you. I mean, you'd certainly think you're you.
But the idea of saving yourself and then transforming that into some sort of a biological state, like you could hang out with 30-year-old you?
I mean, the possibilities are endless.
That's so weird.
I mean, just think like how your phone can record videos on your phone. Mm-hmm. Like there's no way you could remember a video
right.
as accurately as your phone or a camera, you know, could. So now if you've got like some version 10 Neuralink or whatever far in the future, you could recall everything, just like it's a movie.
Crystal clear.
Including all the entire sensory experience.
Emotions. Everything.
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 And play it back.
Do you think you'll be able to share? Edit it.
Yeah.
So you can change your past?
You could change what you think was your past, yeah.
Well, so if you had like a traumatic
this whole thing
experience,
right now could be a replayed memory.
It could be.
Yeah.
It may be. What's the odds of this being a replayed memory? If you had a guess, it's more than 50%.
There's no way to assign a probability with accuracy here.
Right, but roughly. If you just had a gut instinct.
Well, I don't have a neural link in my brain, so I'd say right now 0%. But at the point at which you do have a neural link, then it rises above 0%.
Mm. The idea that we're experiencing some sort of a preserved memory is, even though it's still the same, it's not comforting, right? For some reason, when people talk about simulation theory, they talk about the potential for this currently being a simulation. It, even though your life might be wonderful, you might be in love, you might love your career, you might have great friends, but it's not comforting to know that this experience somehow or another doesn't exist in a material form that you can knock on.
Feels real, doesn't it?
Feels real, but if it's not, but the idea that it's not is so, for some strange reason disconcerting.
Well, I'm sure it should be disconcerting, because then if this is not real, what is?
Right.
But there's that old sort of thought experiment of like, how do you know you're not a brain in a vat? You know. Right now, here's the thing. You are a brain in a vat. Then that vat is your skull.
Yes.
And everything you see, feel, hear, everything, all your senses are electrical signals. Everything. Everything. Is an electrical signal to a brain in a vat, where the vat is your skull.
And all your hormones, all your neurotransmitters, all these things are drugs. Adrenaline's a drug. Dopamine's a drug. Sure. You're a drug factory. You're sure. Constantly changing your state with love and oxytocin and beauty.
Sure.
Changes your state. Great music changes your state.
Absolutely. And yet here's another sort of interesting idea, which is, because you say, like, where did consciousness arise? Well, assuming you believe the belief in physics, which appears to be true, then, you know, the universe started off as basically quarks and leptons, and it quickly became hydrogen and helium, lithium, like basically elements of the periodic table. But it was, you know, like mostly hydrogen, basically. And then over a long period of time, 13.8 billion years later, that hydrogen became sentient. So where along the way where is consciousness? What's the line of consciousness and not consciousness between hydrogen and here?
Right. When do we call it? When do we call it consciousness? Yeah. I was watching a video today that we played on a podcast earlier of a monkey riding a motorcycle down the street, jumps off the motorcycle and tries to steal a baby.
Yeah, I saw that one. It went viral.
What is that monkey conscious? It seems like it is. It seems like it had a plan. It was riding a fucking motorcycle and then jumped off the motorcycle to try to steal a baby. Seems pretty...
The one that just dragged the baby down the street pretty far.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Seems pretty conscious. Right?
There's definitely some degree of consciousness there.
Yeah, it's not like... It's not a worm. It seems to be on another level. Yeah. And it's going to keep going. And that's the real concern when people think about the potential future versions of human beings, especially when you consider symbiotic relationship to artificial intelligence, it will be unrecognizable, that one day we'll be so far removed from what this is. We'll look back on this the way we look back now on, you know, simple organisms that we evolved from, and that it won't be that far in the future that we do have this view back.
Well, I hope consciousness propagates into the future and gets more sophisticated and complex, and that it understands the questions to ask about the universe.
Do you think that's the case? As a human being, as yourself, you're clearly trying to make conscious decisions to be a better version of you, right? This is the idea of like getting rid of your possessions and realizing that you're trying to, like, I don't like this. I will try to improve this. I would try to do a better version of the way I interface with reality. That this is always the way things are. If you're moving in some sort of a direction where you're trying to improve things, you're always going to move into this new place where you look back in the old place and go, oh, I was doing it wrong back then. So this is an accelerated version of that, a super accelerated version of that.
I mean, you don't always improve, but you can aspire to improve. You can aspire to be less wrong.
Yeah.
This is like, I think a good, the tools of physics are very powerful. Like, just assume you're wrong and your goal is to be less wrong. I don't think you're going to if succeed every day in being less wrong, but, you know, if you're going to succeed in being less wrong most of the time, you're doing great.
That's a great way of putting it, aspire to be less wrong. Mm-hmm. But then when, you know, people look back in nostalgia about simpler times, there's that too. It's very romantic and exciting to look back on campfires.
But you can still have a campfire.
Yes.
Yeah.
But will you appreciate it when you're a super nerd, when you're connected to the grid and you have some skull cap in place of the top of your head and it's interfacing with the international language that the rest of the universe now enjoys communication with people? And we're
I think so. I like campfires.
I'm just worried. I mean, everyone's always scared of change, but I'm scared of this monumental change where we won't talk anymore. I mean, that thing
we'll
that you
communicate.
Just yes, but there's something about the beauty of the crudeness of language, where when it's done eloquently, it's satisfying and. It hits us in some sort of a visceral way, like, oh, that person nailed it. I love that they nailed it. Like that it's so hard to capture a real thought and convey it in a way, this articulate way that makes someone excited. Like you read a great quote by a wise person, it makes you excited that their mind figured something out, put the words together in a right way that makes your brain pop. Like, oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
A clever compression of a concept.
Yeah.
And a feeling.
But the fact that a human did it, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think that it'll be like electronic music? Like people won't appreciate it like they appreciate a slide guitar?
I like electronic music.
I do, too.
Yeah.
Well, you make it. I know you like
sure.
it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I hope the future is more fun and interesting, and we should try to make that way.
I hope it's more fun and interesting, too.
Yeah.
You know, I just hope we don't lose anything along the way.
Yeah, we might lose a little. But hopefully we gain more than we lose.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? Gaining more than we lose. Like something that makes us interesting is that we're so flawed.
It's not for sure. Like,
right.
You know. I mean, you look at civilizations through the ages, most of them, you know, they rose and fell.
Yeah.
And I do think like the globalization that we have at the sort of like the meme sphere is there's not enough isolation between countries or regions. It's like if there's a mind virus, that mind virus can infect too much of the world. I actually sort of sympathize with the anti-globalization people because it's like, man, we don't want everywhere to be the same for sure. And then we need some kind of like mind viral immunity. So that's a bit concerning.
Mind viral immunity, meaning that once something like Neuralink gets established, the real concern is something that, I mean, you said it's Bluetooth, right? Or sure. Or some future version of that. That the idea is that something could possibly get into it, fuck it up.
No, I'm talking about like somebody. There's some cockeyed concept that that happens right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Well, I know there's viruses in embedded chips, right? Like people have. They've embedded chips and then acquired viruses.
When I'm talking about a mind virus, I'm talking about like a concept that infects people's minds.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Like cult thinking or sort of fundamentalism.
Yeah, just some wrong-headed idea that just
yes.
goes viral in an idea sense.
Yeah. Mm. Well, that is a problem too, right? If someone can manipulate that technology to make something appear logical or rational.
Yeah.
Would that be an issue too? With this is a very have versus have not issue, right? Once this thing, if this really does, I mean, initially it's going to help people with injuries, but you said ultimately it could lead to this spectacular cognitive change.
Yes.
But the people that first get it. Should have a massive advantage over people that don't have it yet.
Well, I mean, it's the kind of thing where your productivity would improve, I don't know, dramatically, maybe by a factor of 10 with it. So you could definitely just, you know, I don't know, take out a loan and do it and earn the money back real fast.
Yeah.
Be super smart.
Well, in a capitalist society, you know, it seems like you could really get so far ahead that before everybody else could afford this thing and link up and get connected as well, you'd be so far ahead they could never catch you. Is that a concern?
I think the it's not a super huge concern. I mean, there are huge differences in cognitive ability and resources already.
Yeah.
I mean, you can think of a corporation as like a cybernetic collective that's far smarter than an individual. Like I couldn't personally build like a whole rocket and the engines and launch it and everything. That's impossible. But you know, we have 8,000 people at SpaceX and by piecing it out to different people and using like computers and machines and stuff, we can make lots of rockets launch into orbit, dock with the space station, that kind of thing, you know. So that already exists where there's, you know, where there's corporations are vastly more capable than an individual. But we should be, I think, less concerned about like relative capabilities between people and more like having AI be vastly, beyond us and decoupled from human will.
Decoupled from human will. So this is the, if you can't beat them, join them.
Yeah. I mean.
So you feel like it's inevitable, like AI, sentient AI is essentially inevitable.
Super sentient AI, yeah. Like beyond a level that's difficult to understand.
And
impossible to understand, probably.
And somehow or another, it's almost like it's a requirement for survival to achieve some sort of symbiotic existence with AI.
It's not a requirement. It's just if you want to be along for the ride, then you need to do some kind of symbiosis. So the way your brain works right now, you've got kind of like the animal brain, reptile brain, kind of, let's, for argument's sake, it's like the limbic system, basically, and you've got the cortex. Now, the brain purists will argue with this definition, but essentially, you've got the primitive brain, and you've got the sort of smart brain, or the brain that's capable of planning and understanding concepts and difficult, you know, things that a monkey can't understand. Now, the your cortex is much, much smarter than your limbic system. Nonetheless, they work together well. So I haven't met anyone who wants to delete their limbic system or their cortex. People are quite happy having both. So you can think of this as being like the computer, the AI is like a third layer, a tertiary layer. So that is like that could be symbiotic with the cortex. It would be much smarter than the cortex, but you essentially have three layers, and you actually have that right now. Your phone is capable of things, and your computer is capable of things that your brain is definitely not. You know, storing terabytes of information perfectly, doing incredible calculations that we couldn't even come close to doing. You have that with your computer. It's just like I said, the data rate is slow. The connection is weak.
Why is it so disconcerting, or why does it not give me comfort to think about, like, when I think about a symbiotic connection to AI, I always think of this cold, emotionless sort of thing that we will become. Is that a bad way to look at it?
I don't think that's not correct. That's not how it would be. Like I said, you already are symbiotic with AI or computers.
Phones, computers, laptops.
Yeah, and there's quite a bit of AI going on, artificial neural nets. Increasingly, neural nets are sort of taking over from regular programming more and more. So you are connected. If you use Google Voice or Alexa or one of those things, it's using a neural net to decode your speech and try to understand what you're saying. If you're trying to do image recognition or improve the quality of your photograph, it's using the neural net's the best way to do that. So you are already sort of a cybernetic symbiote. Like I said, it's just a question of your data rate. The communication speed between your phone and your brain is slow.
When do you think you're going to do it? How long will you wait? Once it starts becoming available.
Yeah, if it works, I'll do it, sure.
Right away?
I mean, let's make sure it works.
How do we make sure it works? We try it on prisoners? Like, what do you do?
No.
Rapists?
No.
Cut holes in their head?
Now, like I said, if somebody's got a serious brain injury,
right?
And there, people that have like very severe brain injuries, and then you can fix those brain injuries, then you prove out that it works, and you envelope expand and make more and more brain injuries, solve more and more, and then at a certain age, we all are going to get Alzheimer's, we're all going to get senile, and then moms forget the names of their kids and that kind of thing. And so, it's like you said, like, okay, well, this would allow you to remember your names of your kids and have a much more normal life where you're able to function much later in life. So I think that, so essentially that there would, almost everyone would find a need at some point if you get old enough to use Neuralink. And then it's like, okay, so we can improve the functionality and improve the communication speed. So then you will not have to use your thumbs to communicate with the computer.
Do you ever sit down and extrapolate? Do you ever sit down and think about all the different iterations of this and what this eventually leads to?
I think about it a lot. There's not something that's going to sneak up on you. There's like getting FDA approval for this stuff is not like overnight, And there's I don't know, we probably have to be on like version 10 or something before, you know, it would realistically be, you know, a human AI symbiote situation. So you'll see it coming, you know.
You see it coming, but what do you think it's going to be? Like when you sit, when you're alone, if you have free time, I don't know if you have free time, but if you just sit down and think about this iteration, the next, onward, keep going, and you drag it out with improvements along the way and leaps and bounds and technological innovations, and where do you see it? What are we going to be?
Like when?
25 years from now, what are we going to be?
Well, assuming civilization is still around. It's looking fragile right now. I think we could have in 25 years, probably something. I would think there could be a whole brain interface.
A whole brain interface.
Something pretty close to that, yeah.
How do you define? What do you mean by whole brain interface?
Like almost all the neurons are connected to the sort of AI extension of yourself, if you want.
AI extension of yourself.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you? Like when you say AI extension of yourself?
Well, you already have a computer extension of yourself in your mm-hmm. phone, you know, and computers and stuff. So, and now online, it's like somebody dies, there's like an online ghost that they're still, their online stuff is
yeah
still alive.
That's a good way to put it. It is weird when you read someone's tweets after they're dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Instagram and their stories and stuff.
Yeah.
And whatever, Facebook and stuff. You know, like
all that's a great way to put it. It's like an online ghost. That's very accurate.
Yeah. So, yeah, so that there's, it would just be that more of you would be in the cloud, I guess, than in your body. More of you.
Whoa. Now, when you say civilization's fragile, do you mean because of this COVID-19 shit that's going on right now?
What's that? Never heard of it.
It's this thing.
Yeah, no.
It's like some people just get a cough.
No idea what you're talking about.
Other people... It gets much worse.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well. Yeah. I mean, this certainly has taken over the mind space of the world to a degree that is quite shocking.
Yeah. Wow. Out of nowhere. That's what's crazy. It's like you go back to November, nothing. Now here we are, December, January, February, March, April, May, 6 months. Totally different world. So from nothing to everything's locked down. There's so much conflicting information and conflicting opinions about how to proceed. Mm-hmm. What has happened? You find things where there was a meatpacking plant, I believe, in Missouri, where 300 plus people were asymptomatic, tested positive or asymptomatic, and then in other places it just ravages entire communities and kills people. And It's so weird. It almost appears on the, like, if you didn't know any better, you'd be like, what? It seems like there's a bunch of different viruses. It doesn't seem like it's the same thing or has a bunch of different reactions to the biological variety of people.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of saw this whole thing play out in China before it played out in the U.S. So... it's kind of like watching the same movie again, but in English. So, yeah. I think the mortality rate is much less than what say the World Health Organization said it was. It's very, much, much less. It's like probably at least an order of magnitude less.
Well, it seems to be very deadly to very specific kinds of people and people with specific problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you're, you can look at the mortality statistics, you know, by age and whether they have comorbidities, like do they have like basically existing conditions and by age, and you know, if you're below 60 and have no serious health issues, the probability of death is extremely low. It's not zero, but it's extremely low.
They didn't think that this was the case, though, when they first started to lock down the country. Do you think that it's a situation where once they've proceeded in a certain way, it's very difficult to correct course?
It's almost like people really wanted a panic. You know, so it's quite crazy.
But in some places, a panic is deserved, right? Like if you're in the ICU in Manhattan and people are dying left and right and everyone's on intubators, and it seems like when you see all these people on ventilators and so many of them are dying and you see these nurses are dying and doctors are getting sick, in some places that fear is justified. But then in other places, you're reading these stories about hospitals that are essentially half empty. They're having to furlough doctors and nurses because there's no work for them.
Most of the hospitals in the United States right now are half empty. In some cases, they're at 30% capacity.
And is this because they've decided to forego elective procedures and normal things that people would have to go to the hospital for?
Yes. I mean, we're not talking about just some of these elective procedures are quite important.
Yes.
Like it's like you have a bad heart.
Gallbladder disease. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and you need a, you know, triple bypass. It's like sort of elective, but if you don't get it done in time, you're going to die.
Yeah.
It's
elective is a weird word.
Yeah, elective. It's not like, hey, I want to, it's not like plastic surgery or something. It's more like my hip is, I'm in extreme pain because my hip's blown out or my knee and I don't want to go to the hospital. I can't go to the hospital to, you know, people in extreme pain, people that need a kidney, you know, like people that have like quite serious issues that are choosing not to go out of fear. So I think it's a problem. It's not good.
It seems like the state of public perception is shifting.
It is.
Like people are taking some deep breaths and relaxing. And because of the statistics of, I mean, and essentially across the board, it's being recognized that it's not as fatal as we thought it was. Still dangerous, still worse than the flu, but not as bad as we thought or we feared it could be.
I mean, objectively, the mortality is much lower. Like at least a factor of 10, maybe a factor of 50 lower than initially thought.
Do you think that the current way we're handling this, the social distancing, the masks, the locking down, does this make sense? Is it adequate? Or do you think that we should move back to at least closer to where we used to be?
Well, I think proper hygiene is a good thing no matter
what.
You know, wash your hands and, you know, and if you're coughing, stay home or wear a mask. This is not good. You know, like they do that in Japan. That's like normal.
Yeah.
If you're ill, you wear a face mask and you don't cough on people. I think that would be a great thing to adopt in general throughout the world. washing your hands is also good.
Well, that's the speculation why men get it more than women, because men are disgusting. We don't wash our hands.
Men are disgusting.
As much.
It's true.
It's true.
Yeah,
I admit
bad.
It. We're all men in this room. We're all gross.
Yeah, let's go to the restroom. You can see us.
Yes,
horrible.
We're gross. My daughter, my 9-year-old daughter, yells at me. She goes, "Did you wash your hands?" She makes me go back and wash my hands.
Hmm.
She's right. 9 years old. If I had a 9-year-old boy, do you think he would care?
No.
He wouldn't give a fuck if I washed my hands.
True. So, yeah, I think there's definitely some silver linings here in improved, hygiene.
Yes.
And
awareness of potential.
Yes. And I think this has shaken up the system. The system is like somewhat moribund with a lot of layers of bureaucracy. And I think that we've, you know, cut through some of that bureaucracy. And if we, you know, at some point there probably will be a pandemic with a high mortality rate. you know, there's debate about like what's high, but I mean like something that's killing a lot of 20-year-olds, let's say. Like, right. Like it's,
yes.
If you had like Ebola type of mortality.
Spanish flu, something that attacks the immune systems of healthy people.
But it's killing large numbers of young, healthy people, that's, you know, define that as like a high mortality, then that this is at least practice for something like that. And I think there's you know, given it's just a matter of time that there will be eventually some such pandemic.
Do you think that in a sense, the one good thing that we might get out of this is the realization that this is a potential reality, that we got lucky in the sense, I mean, in people that didn't get lucky and died, of course, I'm not disrespecting their death and their loss, but I'm saying overall as a culture, as a community, as a human race, as a community, this is not as bad as it could have been. This is a good dry run for us to appreciate that we need far more resources dedicated towards understanding these diseases, what to do in the case of pandemic, and much more money that goes to funding treatments and some preventative measures.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a good chance, it's highly likely, I think, coming out of this, that we will develop vaccines that we didn't have before for you know, coronaviruses and other viruses and possibly cures for these. And our understanding of viruses of this nature has improved dramatically because of the attention that it's received. So there's definitely some, you know, a lot of silver linings here. And
potentially, if we act correctly.
Yeah. There's, I think there will be some amount of silver lining here no matter what. Hopefully it could be more of a silver lining than less. This is like kind of like a practice run for something that had a, you know, potential that might in the future have a serious, like a really high mortality rate. Kind of got to go through this without it being something that kills, you know, vast numbers of young, healthy people.
Yeah. When you made a series of tweets recently, I don't remember the exact wording, but essentially you were saying free America now. Like, let's
that is
open
the exact
it
wording.
That is it? Thank you. But what was the how much do you pay attention to the response to that stuff, and what was the response? Like, did anybody go, hey, Elon, what the fuck are you doing? Did anybody pull you aside?
Of course.
Who does that? Who gets to do that to you?
Well, I mean, I certainly get that. There's no shortage of negative feedback on Twitter, you know.
Oh, yeah, Twitter.
Yeah.
But I don't read that. Yeah, do you read it?
War zone.
You do sometimes, though, right? You do read it.
Yeah, I mean, I scroll through the comments. Like I said, as a meme war zone.
Yeah.
I mean, people knife you good on Twitter.
It's something I enjoy about that. Just the there's a something about the freedom of expression that comes from all these people that do attack you. It's like, well, if there was no vulnerability whatsoever, they wouldn't attack you. And it's like there's something about these millions and millions of perspectives that you have to appreciate, even if it comes your way, even if the shit storm hits you in the face.
Sure.
You got to appreciate, wow, how amazing is it that all these people do have the ability to express themselves? I mean, you don't necessarily want to be there when the shit hits you.
Sure.
You might want to get out of the way in anticipation of the shit storm, but the fact that so many people have the ability to reach out, and I think it's in a lot of ways, it's I don't want to say a misused resource, but it's like giving monkeys guns. They just start they start gunning down things that are in front of them without any realization of what they're doing. They have a rock. They see a window. They throw it. Woo! Look at that! I got Elon mad. Look at that! This guy got mad at me. I fucking took this person down on Twitter. I got this lady fired. Oh, the fucking business is going under because of Twitter wars. It seems like there's something about it that's this newfound thing that I don't want to say abuse, but just I want to say that it's almost like You know, you hit the button and things blow up. You're like, wow, this is, what else can we blow up?
Sure. I mean, I've been in the Twitter war zone for a while here. So,
Twitter war zone?
You know, it takes a lot to phase me at this point.
Yeah. That's good too, right? Like you develop a thick skin.
Yeah. You can't take it personally. Like, well, these people don't like actually know you. You know, like,
yeah.
It's just like, you know, it's like if you're fighting a war and there's like some opposing soldier that shoots at you, it's not like they hate you. They don't even know you.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just think of it like that. Like they're firing bullets, whatever. But they don't know you, so don't take it personally.
There's something interesting about it too. It's like when you write something in, you know, 280 characters and they write something in two, it's such a crude way. It's like, you know, someone saying, sending opposing smoke signals that refute your smoke signals. It's like, it's so crude, and especially when you're talking about something like Neuralink. You're talking about some future potential where you're going to be able to express pure thoughts that get conveyed through some sort of a universal language with no ambiguity whatsoever versus, you know, tweets.
Well, there'll always be some ambiguity, but
yeah.
Tweets are—it's hard. Maybe there should be like a sarcasm flag or something, you know?
Right, right.
I'm not, you know, just kidding or whatever, you know.
But
like, you know,
it seems like it would take away some of the fun from people that know it's sarcasm. Like if everybody knew that The Onion wasn't real, if you sent people articles,
yeah,
it was something about someone getting angry at an Onion article.
Wow, that's amazing.
You know what I mean? Where they don't realize what it is? There's something fun about that for everybody else.
Onion's pretty great. Might be the best news source.
Do you know who Titania McGrath is? Hilarious. It's Andrew Boyle. He's a British fellow,
okay.
Brilliant guy who's been on the podcast before, and he has this fictional character, this pseudonym, Titania McGrath, who's like this the ultimate social justice warrior.
Is this like a female avatar?
Yes,
or something?
Yes. Okay. A female avatar that's actually a computer conglomeration of a bunch of faces.
Okay.
It's not really one person, so okay. One person can't be a victim and be angry. He's sort of combined these faces to make this one perfect social justice warrior.
Okay.
But the thing, I recognized it early on before I met him.
Sure.
That this was parody. This was just fun, and then I love reading the people that don't recognize that. They get angry.
Sure.
And they're really, really, like, there's a lot of people that just get really furious.
Sure.
About some of, there's some fun to that. There's some fun to the not picking up on the true nature of the signal.
I find Twitter quite engaging.
How do you have the time?
It's like 5 minutes every couple hours type thing. It's not like I'm sitting on it all day.
But even 5 minutes every couple hours, if those are bad 5 minutes, they might be bouncing around your head for the next 30.
Yeah, you have to, you know, like I said, take a certain amount of distance from, you read this and you're like, okay, it's bullets being fired by an opposing army. But, you know, don't like, it's not like they, like I said, it's not like they know you. It's like, don't take it personally.
Did you feel the same way when CNN had that stupid shit about ventilators with you? I found that both confusing and the
yeah, that was annoying.
It was annoying.
It was wrong.
But it's also annoying as a person who reads CNN and wants to think of them as a responsible conveyor of the facts. I would like to think that.
Yeah. I don't think CNN is that.
I think it used to be.
It used to be, yeah. What do you think's the best source of just like information out there? Like,
that's a good question.
You know, let's say you're just like average citizen trying to just get the facts. You know, figure out what's going on. Like, you know, how to live your life, and you know, just looking for what's going on in the world. That it's hard to find something that isn't, you know, that's good.
Yeah.
You know. Not trying to push some partisan angle, not sort of doing sloppy reporting and just aiming for the most number of clicks and trying to maximize ad dollars and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You're just trying to figure out what's going on. It's like, I'm hard pressed to, where do you go?
I don't know. I don't think there's any pure form. My favorite places are the New York Times and the LA Times, and I don't trust them 100%. You know, because also there's individuals that are writing these stories.
Yeah, exactly.
And that seems to be the problem, is these individual biases and these individual – there's purposely distorted perceptions, and then there's ignorantly reported facts. And there's so many variables, and you got to put everything through this filter of where is this person coming from? Do they have political biases? Do they have social biases? Are they upset because of their own shortcomings, and are they projecting this into the story?
Sure,
it's so hard.
Yeah, I think like maybe just trying to find individual reporters that you think are good and kind of following them as opposed to the publication.
I go with whatever Matt Taibbi says.
Okay,
I trust him more than anybody.
All right.
Matt Taibbi's onto something. He's as far as investigative reporters in particular, the way he reported the savings and loan crisis, the way he reports everything. I just listen to him above most. He's my go-to guy.
All right, I'll check it out.
His Rolling Stones articles are amazing. His stuff on the savings and loan crisis, you're just like, what in the fuck?
Sure.
And, you know, and he wasn't, you know, he's not an economist by any stretch of the imagination, so he had to really sort of deeply embed himself in that world to try to understand it and to be able to report on it.
Yep.
And with a humorous flair.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah. But there's not that many of them. It's hard. And not a location where, like, we are no bullshit.
Sure.
You know, wearenobullshit.com. Like, the one place where you can say, this is what we know, this is what we don't know, this is what we think. Not, this person's wrong, and here's why. Like, oh, God damn it. You know, I can't. You don't know. There's a lot of stuff that is open to interpretation.
Yeah.
This particular coronavirus issue that we're dealing with right now seems to be a great illuminator of that very fact, is that there's so much data, and there's so much that's open to interpret. There's so many things, because it's all happening in real time, right? And like particularly right now in California, we're in stage two tomorrow or Friday, 2 days from now. Stage two, retail stores opening up, things are changing. Like no one knows the correct process that needs to take place to save the most amount of lives, but yet ensure that our culture and that our economy survives. It's a lot of speculation and guessing, but if you go to certain places, they'll tell you, we know why, and we know this, and we know it's hard.
Yeah, I mean, in general, I think that's like we should be concerned about anything that's a massive infringement on our civil liberties.
Yes.
You know, so it's like you got to put a lot of weight on that. You know, a lot of people died to, you know, win independence for the country and fight for the democracy that we have. And, you know, we should treasure that and not give up our liberties too easily. I think I think we probably did that, actually.
So, well, I like what you said when you said that it should be a choice, and that to require people to stay home, require people to not go to work, and to arrest people for trying to make a living. This all seems wrong, and I think it's a wrong approach. It's an infantilization of the society. That daddy's going to tell you what to do.
Fundamentally, a violation of the Constitution.
Yes.
Freedom of assembly, and you know, it's just. I mean, I don't think these things stand up in court, really.
They're arresting people for protesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they're protesting and violating social distancing and these mandates that tell people that they have to stay home.
Yeah, these would definitely not stand up, you know, if the Supreme Court here. I mean, it's obviously a complete violation of rights.
Yeah. And again, this is not in any way disrespecting the people who have died from this disease.
No.
It's certainly a real thing to think of.
Yeah, I mean, it just should be if you're at risk, you should not be compelled to leave your house,
right?
Or leave a place of safety. But you should also not be if you're not at risk, or if you are at risk and you wish to take a risk with your life, you should have the right to do that.
And it seems like at this point in time, particularly, our resources would be best served protecting the people that are at risk versus penalizing the people that are not at high risk. for living their life the way they did, particularly having a career and making a living and feeding your family, paying your bills, keeping your store open, keeping your restaurant open.
Yes. I mean, there's a strong downside to this.
Yeah.
I just believe, like, you know, if this is a free country, you should be, you know, allowed to do, you know, what you want as long as it does not endanger others.
But that's the thing, right? People, this is the argument they will bring up. Like, you are endangering others. You should stay home for the people that you even if you're fine, even if you know you're going to be okay, there's certain people that will not be okay because of your actions. They might get exposed to this thing that we don't have a vaccine for, we don't have universally accepted treatment for, and then we need to – there's two arguments, right? The one argument is we need to keep going, protect the weak, protect the sick, but let's open up the economy. The other argument is stop placing money over human lives and let's shelter in place until we come up with some sort of a decision, and let's figure out some way to develop some sort of a universal basic income plan or something like that to feed people during this time when we make this transition.
I think there's a as I said, my opinion is if somebody wants to stay home, they should stay home. And if somebody doesn't want to stay home, they should not be compelled to stay home. That's my opinion.
Do you think
if somebody doesn't like that, well, that's my opinion. This notion though that you can just sort of send checks out to everybody and things will be fine is not true. Obviously, some people have this absurd, like, view that the economy is like some magic horn of plenty. Like, it just makes stuff, you know, whatever, it just, there's a magic horn of plenty, and the goods and services, they just come from this magic horn of plenty. And then if somebody has more stuff than somebody else, it's because they took more from this magic horn of plenty. Now, let me just break it to the fools out there. If you don't make stuff, there's no stuff. Yeah. So if you don't make the food, if you don't process the food, you don't transport the food, and medical treatment, getting your teeth fixed, there's no stuff. I become detached from reality. You can't just legislate money and solve these things. If you don't make stuff, there is no stuff. Obviously, we'll run out of the stores, run out of the machine just grinds to a halt.
But the initial thought on this virus, the real fear was that this was going to kill hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people instantaneously in this country. It was going to do it very quickly. If we didn't hunker down, if we didn't shelter in place, if we didn't quarantine ourselves or lock down, do you think that the initial thought was a good idea based on the perception that this was going to be far more deadly than it turned out to be?
Maybe. I think briefly.
Briefly.
Briefly. I think if you know any kind of like sensible examination of what happened in China would lead to the conclusion that that is obviously not going to occur. This virus originated in Wuhan. There's like, I don't know, 100,000 people a day leaving Wuhan. It went everywhere, very fast. Throughout China, throughout the rest of the world, and the fatality rate was low.
Don't you think, though, it's difficult to appreciate? It's difficult to filter what the information that's coming out of China, to accurately, really get a real true representation of what happened. The propaganda machine is very strong.
Sure.
The World Health Organization appears to have been complicit with a lot of their propaganda.
The thing is that American companies have massive supply chains in China, like Tesla, for example. We have hundreds of suppliers, like tier 1, 2, 3, 4 suppliers throughout China. So we know if they are able to make stuff or not. We know if they have issues or not. Then China is back at full steam. Many, pretty much every U.S. company has some significant number of suppliers in China. So you know if they're able to, you know, provide things or not, or if there's, you know, high mortality rate. Tesla has 7,000 people in China, so zero people died.
Hmm.
Zero.
Okay, so that's a real statistic. That's coming from, those people.
Yeah, we literally run payroll.
Do you think there's a danger of this? same folks are there.
Yeah, still there.
Do you think there's a danger of politicizing this, where it becomes like opening up the country's Donald Trump's, it's his goal. It's his, and then anything he does is sort of there's people that are going to oppose it and come up with some reasons why he's wrong, particularly in this climate, whereas as we're leading up to November and, you know, the 2020 elections. Do you think that this is a real danger in terms of public's perception, that Trump wants to open it up so they knee-jerk oppose it because they oppose Trump?
I think there has been some this has been politicized, you know, in both directions, really. So it's which is not great. But like I said, separate and apart from that, I think there's the question of, like, you know, where do civil liberties fit in this picture, you know?
Yeah.
And what can the government make you do? What can they make you not do? And what, you know, what's okay?
Right.
I think we went too far.
Do you think it's one of those things where once we've gone in a certain direction, it's very difficult to make a correction, make an adjustment to realize, like, okay, we thought it was one thing. It's not good, but it's not what we thought it was going to be. It's not what we feared. So let's back up and reconsider, and let's do this publicly and say we were acting based on the information that we had initially. That information appears to be faulty, and here's how we move forward while protecting civil liberties, while protecting what essentially this country was founded on, which is a very agreed upon amount of freedom that we respect and appreciate.
Absolutely. Well, I think we're rapidly moving towards opening up the country. It's going to happen extremely fast over the next few weeks. So something that would be helpful just to add from an informational level is when reporting sort of COVID cases, to separate out diagnosed with COVID versus had COVID-like symptoms.
Yes.
Because the list of symptoms that could be COVID at this point is like a mile long. So it's like hard to, if you're ill at all, it's like it could be COVID. So just to give people better information, definitely diagnosed with COVID or had COVID-like symptoms. We're conflating those two so that it looks bigger than it is. Then if somebody dies, was COVID a primary cause of the death or not? If somebody has COVID, gets eaten by a shark, we find their arm has COVID. It's going to get recorded as a COVID death.
Is that real?
I mean, basically.
Not that bad, but heart attacks, strokes.
You get hit by a bus.
Cancer.
If you get hit by a bus, go to the hospital and die, and they find that you have COVID, you will be recorded as a COVID death.
Why would they do that, though?
Well, right now, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I mean, it's mostly paved with bad intentions, but there is, you know, some good intention paving stones in there too. And the stimulus bill that was intended to help with the hospitals that were being overrun with COVID patients created an incentive to record something as COVID that is difficult to say no to, especially if your hospital is going bankrupt for lack of other patients. So the hospitals are in a bind right now. There's a bunch of hospitals they're furloughing doctors, as you were mentioning. If your hospital is half full, it's hard to make ends meet. So now you've got, like, you know, if I just check this box, I get $8,000. Put them on a ventilator for 5 minutes, I get $39,000. or I got to fire some doctors. So this is a tough moral quandary. It's like, what are you going to do? That's the situation we have.
What's the way out of this? What do you think is, like, if you had the president's ear, or if people wanted to just listen to you openly, what do you think is the way out of this?
So let's clear up the data. Clear up the data. So, like I said, something should be recorded as COVID only if it is somebody has been tested, has received a positive COVID test, not if they simply have symptoms, one of like 100 symptoms. And then if it is a COVID death, it must be separated. Was COVID a primary reason for death, or did they also have stage 3 cancer, heart disease, emphysema, and got hit by a bus and had COVID?
Yeah, I've read all this stuff about that, about them diagnosing people as a COVID death despite other variables.
This is not a question. This is what is occurring.
And where are you reading this from? Where are you getting this from?
The public health officials have literally said this. This is not a question mark.
Right. But this is unprecedented, right? Like, if someone had the flu but also had a heart attack, they would assume that person died of a heart attack.
Yes.
Yeah. So this is unprecedented. Is this because this is such a popular, I don't want to use that word the wrong way, but that's what I mean, a popular subject? And financial incentives.
Yes. And like I said, this is not some sort of a moral indictment of sort of hospital administrators. It's just they're in a tough spot here. They actually don't have enough patients to pay everyone without furloughing doctors and you know, firing staff, and they're running potentially going bankrupt. So then they're like, okay, well, the stimulus bill says if we get all this, money, if it's a COVID death, I'm like, okay, they coughed before they died. In fact, they're not even diagnosed as COVID. They simply, if you had weakness, a cough, shortness of breath. Like, frankly, I'm not sure how you die without those things.
Yeah.
You.
Right. There's so many different things that you could attribute to COVID too. There's so many symptoms. There's diarrhea, headaches, dehydration, cough. Yeah.
Yes, but to be clear, you don't even need to have gotten a COVID diagnosis.
Right.
You simply need to have had one of many symptoms, and then have died for some reason, and it's COVID. So then it makes the death count look very high. And then we're then stuck in a bind because it looks like the death count's super high and not going down like it should be, and now so then we should keep whatever keep the shelter in place stuff there and keep people in their home, confine people to their homes. So we need to break out of this. We're stuck in a loop.
Yeah.
And I think the way to break out of this loop is to have clarity of information.
Clarity of information will certainly help, but altering perceptions, public perception, from people that are basically in a panic. There's a lot of at least a month ago, we're clearly in a panic. I mean, right where, when you look around April 5th, April 6th, people were really freaking out. Mm-hmm. But here we are, May, and May, people are relaxing a little bit.
Yes.
They're realizing like, hey, I actually know a couple of people that got it. It was just a cough. And I know some people that got it where nothing happened.
I know a lot of people who got it. I know zero people who died. I mean, I know a lot of people who got it.
Yeah, it's not what we feared. We feared something much worse.
Yeah, that's correct.
So the adjustment's difficult to make. So you said, first of all, we need real data. We need...
Just parse out the data. Don't lump it all together.
No.
And then if you give people, just parse out the data better, clearer information, about like I said, was this an actual COVID diagnosis or was it did they get the test and the test came back positive, or do they just have some symptoms? Just parse those two out, and then parse out if somebody died, did they die? Did they even have a COVID test, or did they just have one of many symptoms? Like like, how do you die without weakness? I don't know.
Right.
It's impossible, basically.
Yeah, that's a good point.
If you're going to die, you're going to have shortness of breath, weakness, and you might cough a little.
So was it quantified? Was it?
Yeah, did they actually have a COVID test? And the test come back positive? And then if they died, did they die where COVID was? It doesn't have to be the main cause, but it was a significant contributor to their death. Or was it not a significant contributor to the death?
Right. It's not as simple as just because you had COVID, COVID killed you.
It's definitely not.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, people die all the time and they have like flu and you know, other colds. And we don't say that they died of those flu and other colds.
Well, that's what's so weird
about
absurd.
This.
It's so popular. And I use that word in a weird way, but it's so popular that we've kind of forgotten. People die of pneumonia every day. People die of the flu didn't take a break. Oh, COVID's got this. I'm going to sit this one out. I'm going to be on the bench. I'm going to wait until COVID's done before I jump back into the game of killing people. No, the flu's still here killing people.
I mean, every year in the world, several hundred thousand people die directly of the flu.
Yeah.
Not tangentially.
Right.
Not every
61,000 in this country last year.
Yeah. And we're only 5% of the world.
And then there's cigarettes.
So, oh man, cigarettes. Now, cigarettes will really kill you.
That's a weird one, right? We're terrified of this disease that we're projected could potentially kill 100, if not 200,000 Americans this year. Would cigarettes kill 500,000? And you don't hear a peep out of any politician. There's no one running for Congress that's trying to ban cigarettes. There's no one running for Senate that wants to put some education plan in place that's going to stop cigarettes in their tracks.
Yeah, I mean, long time, like several years ago, or maybe along 10 years ago, I helped make a movie called Thank You for Smoking.
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah. It's crazy. Barbecuing your lungs is just bad news. It's not good. You know, you're turning your lungs into smoked beef is not great.
But it's
Tylenol also, by the way, also kills a lot of people.
Yeah, what is the number for Tylenol every year?
I'm not sure the exact number, but I believe it until the opioid crisis, I believe Tylenol was the number one killer of all drugs. Because basically it's if you get drunk and take a lot of Tylenol, acetaminophen, essentially it causes liver failure.
Oh.
so people would like get wasted and then like have a headache and then pop a ton of Tylenol, just curtains.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Curtains is a funny word.
Yeah. You know, so, but no, nobody's like, damn. You know, raging against Tylenol.
Yeah. It's weird, except acceptable deaths are weird. And that's the slippery slope about this people shaming people for wanting to go back to work. You know, other people are going to die. Well, if you drive, do you drive? Okay, well, you should stop driving because people die from driving. So, you definitely should fill up all the swimming pools because like 50 people die every day in this country from swimming. So let's not swim anymore.
Yeah,
like,
what is the really dangerous?
We need to chop down all the coconut
trees.
Stop
water.
Coconuts kill 150 people every year.
Yes.
Cut down all the coconut trees. We need those people.
Yes.
It's at a certain point in time, it's like, we're vulnerable. And we have a finite existence no matter what.
We do. Nobody lives forever.
Right.
I think you want to look at, say, deaths as like the... But for this disease or whatever, they would have lived X number of years.
Yeah.
You know, so, if somebody dies when they're 20 and could have lived till 80, they lost 60 years. But if somebody dies when they're 80 and they might have lived till 81, they lost 1 year.
Yes.
So it's like how many life years were lost is a probably, the right metric to use.
I don't read my own comments, but I do read other people's comments. And I was reading this one little Twitter beef that was going on, where someone was saying that COVID takes an average of 10 years off people's lives, and we should appreciate those 10 years. And then someone else said...
It's not true.
I'm sure it's not true.
Yeah, definitely
not. It's the Twitter. It's the world.
Oh, my God.
But someone else said the average age of people who die from COVID is older than the average age people die.
It's very... Let's say it's about the same.
That's a beautiful way of looking at it. I mean, it's unfortunate. It sucks. But it sucks if grandpa dies of Alzheimer's or emphysema or leukemia. It sucks.
Sure.
It sucks when someone you love dies.
Yes.
But I'm...
I mean, actually, if this... I think a lesson to be taken here that I think is quite important is that if you have grandparents and their age of grandparents, really be careful with you know, any kind of flu or cold or something that is not dangerous to kids or young adults, but is dangerous to the elderly. Is if your kid's got a runny nose, they should stay away from their grandparents.
Yeah.
No matter what it is, it's the things that are where a young immune system has no problem, and an older one has a problem.
Yes.
And in fact, a lot of the deaths are literally it's tragic, but they're intra-family. It's the little kid had a you know, cold or flu and
give it to grandpa.
Have the family gathering, and they don't know that this is a big deal, but it's just important to remember when you get old, your immune system's just not that strong, and so just be careful with your you know, loved ones who are elderly.
And I think there is some true objective understanding of the immune system and the ways to boost that immune system, and I really think that information should be distributed in a way, a non-judgmental way, but like, look, this is a way that we can all, like, this is a scientifically proven way that we can boost our immune system, mm-hmm. and it might save your life, and it might save the life of your loved ones, and maybe we could teach this to our grandparents and our parents and people that are vulnerable. You know, vitamin C, heat shock proteins, all these different variables that we know contribute to a stronger immune system.
Yeah. A thing that is tough. As you get older, it's hard to be. You tend to put on weight. You know, certainly that's happening with me. You know, like as the older I get, I'm like, damn, sure, it's harder to stay lean. That's for sure. So actually being overweight is a big deal.
Yeah,
it's a fact. Yeah.
The New York Hospital said it was the number one factor for severe COVID symptoms was obesity. That was the number one factor.
It is. That's yes. Exactly.
But it's also we live in a world where people want to be sensitive to other people's feelings.
So yeah, absolutely.
We don't want to bring up the fact that being fat's bad for you. It's a judgment on your...
The food's great.
Yeah. I do love food.
Yeah, and I mean, to be totally frank, I mean, speaking for myself, I'd rather eat tasty food and live a shorter life. Yeah, you know.
Yeah, those moments of enjoying a great meal.
Yeah.
And then even talking about it, they're valuable. They're worth something. Yeah, it's not. We don't want to eat Soylent Green and live to be 160.
No. I don't want to eat. Tasty food is great. It's one of the best things about life.
It really is. Yeah, it's an art form as well. It's like fine food. It's a delicious sandcastle. It's temporary. It doesn't last very long, but there's something about it that's very pleasing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what advice to give. Like, maybe smaller, have the tasty food, but smaller amounts of it.
Yes. Yeah. And I think regulated feeding windows really the way to go. Some sort of an intermittent fasting approach.
Sure.
When I started doing that, I found myself to be quite a bit healthier. And when I've deviated from that, I've gained weight.
So what's
16 hours. Well, okay, 16 hours. Yeah.
So like at night or?
Yeah. So I get to a certain point and then I count out. I usually hit the stopwatch on my phone. And then I look at 15 hours in. I'm like, oh, okay, got an hour before I can eat.
Yeah.
And so anything in between that is just water or coffee.
Actually, you know, like this may be a useful bit of advice for people, but eating before you go to bed is a real bad idea and actually negatively affects your sleep.
Yeah.
And it can actually cause heartburn that you don't even know is happening. And that subtle heartburn affects your sleep because you're horizontal and your body's digesting. So if you want to improve the quality of your sleep be healthier, it's do not eat right before we're going to sleep.
Yeah,
it's like one of the worst things you could do.
I had some of the biggest mistakes I've ever made. I've done that particularly after comedy shows. I'm starving. Sure. I'll come home and I'll eat, and then I go to bed and I just feel like shit. And I wake up in the middle of the night. Like,
it's gonna crush your sleep, and it's gonna damage your pyloric sphincter and your esophagus, and it's so. In fact, drinking and then going to sleep is one of the worst things you can do.
Yes.
So just try to avoid drinking and eating
booze.
Exactly. Yeah. Don't you know. Small amounts of alcohol, that evidence suggests it doesn't have a negative effect on
it. I put it in the same category as delicious food. It kind of makes things a little more fun.
I like
it.
I mean, some of the people who have lived the longest, there was a woman in France who I think maybe has the record or close to it, and she had a glass of wine every day, you know.
So yeah. It's
like small amounts is fine. Yeah, this is like I learned this like quite late in life. It's like just avoid having alcohol and avoid eating at least 2 or 3 hours before going to sleep, and your quality of sleep will improve, and your general health will improve a lot.
For sure,
it's a big deal, and I think not widely known.
Do you have time to exercise?
A little bit.
Do you have a trainer or anything?
I do, although I haven't seen him. For a while, but if I'm out, like say working on a starship or something in South Texas, and I'm just living in my, I got a little house there in Boca Chica Village, don't have much to do, so I'm working and then I'll just lift some weights or something, you know. Some people love running, I don't love running.
What do you like to do exercise-wise?
To be totally frank, I wouldn't exercise at all if I could. But I'd prefer not to exercise. But if I'm going to exercise, and lift some weights, and then kind of run on the treadmill, and maybe watch a show that, you know, if there's a compelling show that like pulls you in.
Right. Yeah, you know, that's a good thing to do. Yeah. Watch a good movie or episode of Black Mirror or something like that. It's great.
Man, don't watch Black Mirror before going to bed either.
Well, don't watch Black Mirror today. Yeah. It's too fucking accurate.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, wait, this already happened in real life.
Yeah, it's too close.
It's too close.
Well, even, didn't you say that the guy who makes Black Mirror?
Today yet? Oh, my mic's off. He said it's not a good time to start season 6.
Yeah, he wants to hold off because reality
he's nailed it.
Is Black Mirror.
Oh, man.
It's like he's going to have to like reassess and attack it from a different angle.
Yeah.
You should try something that's fun to do, that's not just like learn a martial art or something like that.
I did martial arts when I was a kid.
Like, did you? What'd you do?
Yeah. I did taekwondo. I did karate, kyokushinkai karate.
Oh, all right. Cool.
And judo.
Also, you really branched out.
Yeah. And did Brazilian jiu-jitsu briefly.
Did you?
Yeah.
Where?
In Palo Alto.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, no shit. I was going to suggest that. That's a great thing for people. Like, that's a thing about jiu-jitsu. If you look at it from the outside, you think, oh, a bunch of meatheads strangling each other.
Sure.
But there's some of the smartest people I know are jiu-jitsu fiends because they get introduced to it because usually either they want to exercise or learn some self-defense.
Sure.
But then they realize that it's essentially like a language with your body, you're having an argument with someone with some sort of a physical language, and it's really complex. And the more access to vocabulary and the sharper your words are, the more you'll succeed in these ventures. That's really an accurate analogy of what jiu-jitsu is.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of got, I mean, probably like a lot of people, for the first MMA fights in Hoist Gracie, and he was just like incredible.
Yes.
And it was like, you
technique.
Know, Yeah, yeah. It was like, you know, winning against people way bigger and that kind of thing. It was just like, whoa, this is cool.
It was what martial arts were supposed to be when we were kids.
Yeah.
When you saw Bruce Lee fuck up all these big giant guys, yeah. Like, wow, martial arts allow you to beat someone far bigger and stronger than you.
Right.
Most of the time, that's not real.
Especially if they know martial arts, too.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, no.
Yes, but in the UFC, when Hoist Gracie, off of his back, was strangling Dan Severn with his legs, you're like, holy shit.
Yeah.
This guy's being pinned by this big, giant wrestler, and he wraps his legs around his neck and chokes him to the point the guy has to surrender.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, Hoist got beaten up pretty bad in some of those.
He definitely had some rough fights.
But
he won. He's a legend. But what it showed, and I mean, I'm a huge lover of jiu-jitsu. What it showed is that there is a method for diffusing these situations with technique and knowledge.
Yeah.
And I think it's also a great way to exercise, too, because it's almost like the exercise is secondary to the learning of the thing. The exercise is like you want to develop strength and conditioning just so that you could be better at doing the thing.
Sure.
And the analogy that I use is like imagine if you had a race car and you could actually give the race car better handling and more horsepower just from your own focus and effort.
Sure.
That's really what it's like.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. When am I going to be able to?
My kids, I should say, I sent my kids to jiu-jitsu since they were like, I don't know, six.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's been a while, yeah.
It's a great thing to learn. It really is.
Seems like a good, yes.
Yeah. Maybe something like, I mean, even if you just have someone who holds the pads for you, like you get a workout in and it'd be fun. When am I going to be able to buy one of them roadsters? When's that happening?
Well, I can't, you know, say exactly when, but we got to get it, you know, this COVID thing's kind of thrown us for a loop.
I'm sure.
So, not to blame everything on COVID, but it's certainly set us back on progress for some number of months. The things we've got to get done ahead of Roadster are ramping up Model Y production. That'll be a great car. It is a great car. Getting the Berlin Gigafactory built, and also building Y, expanding the Shanghai factory, which is going great, get the Cybertruck, semi truck, Roadster. Roadster is kind of like dessert, so like we gotta get the meat and potatoes and greens and stuff,
But Roadster comes before Cybertruck.
I mean, I think we should do Cybertruck first before Roadster.
Interesting.
Now
I'm not mad at that.
Some of the things for Roadster, they're the tri-motor, plaid powertrain. We're gonna have that in Model S, so that's like one of the ingredients that's needed for Roadster is the plaid powertrain, the more advanced battery pack, that kind of thing.
I wanted to ask you about this before I forgot. There's a company that's called Apex. It's taking your Teslas and they're giving it a wider base and wider tires and a little bit more advanced suspension.
Sure.
How do you feel about that?
Do you work with them?
Are you cool with those people?
Yeah. I mean, go ahead.
They're jazzing stuff up with carbon fiber and doing a bunch of interior choices. You're cool with that? You can't fuck with that. You don't have time. So is it good that someone comes along and has a sort of specialty operation?
I got no problem.
That's what it's called, right? It's like, J-Mang, is it called Apex?
Yeah, I got a Unplugged Performance S Apex.
That's right, yeah. Unplugged Performance, yeah.
Yeah, you could for sure lighten the car up and improve to tire traction. And
have you seen that company's stuff, what they do?
I don't know specifically, but
it's pretty dope.
Yeah.
They make a pretty dope looking. They take Model S and they widen it and give it a bunch of carbon fiber. That's it right there.
Cool.
Ooh la la! Look at that.
Looks pretty nice.
Yeah, it does. Now the plaid version of the Model S. Are you going to widen the track and do a bunch of different things? I know you guys are testing at the Nürburgring. Can you not talk about that?
Well, I think we got to leave that for a proper sort of product unveil.
I understand.
Yeah,
I understand. Last time you were here, you convinced me to buy a Tesla. I bought it, and it's fucking insane.
Oh, great. Glad you like it.
Ah, man.
Pretty fun.
I don't. It's not just pretty fun. It's like the way I've described it is it makes other cars seem stupid. They just seem dumb. Like, and I love dumb things. I love dumb cars. Like, sure. I love campfires.
Yeah,
I love
totally.
Campfires. I have a 1993 Porsche that's air-cooled.
Sure.
It's like it's not that fast. It's really slow compared to Tesla.
Yeah, really slow. It's really quite slow. But
yeah. But there's something engaging about the mechanical, just like the gears, and it's very analog. But it's so stupid in comparison to the Tesla. Like, when I want to go somewhere in the Model S, I hit the gas and it just goes, whee!
Yeah.
It just, it like, violates time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, you've tried it, like, Ludicrous Plus and stuff
like
that.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We just did a software update where it'll do, a cheetah stance. So because it's got a dynamic air suspension, so it lowers the back.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, just like a sprinter, basically.
Right.
Like, what do you do if you're a sprinter? You, like, hunker down, and then I shaved, like, a tenth of a second off the 0-60. I mean, like, you know. It's pretty fun.
It's so I've taken so many people, and I'm like, I take them for the holy shit moment. I'm like, are you ready? Like, hang on there. And then I stomp on the gas.
That I've never felt anything like it.
It's confusing.
Yeah.
It really is.
Sure.
The instant torque mm-hmm. and just the sheer acceleration is baffling.
It's baffling.
It's baffling.
They've never felt it.
No.
It's faster than falling.
It's crazy. It's so fast. It's a roller coaster.
Yeah.
And my family yells at me when I stomp the gas. Like, I tell my kids, I'm like, you want to feel it? You want to feel it? Like, do it. My wife's like, don't do it.
Yeah.
Boom. What?
Yeah.
And even if I just do it on the highway for a couple of seconds,
yeah, it's
very
fun.
Exciting.
Yeah.
It's very
fun. It's like having your own roller coaster on tap, you know?
It really is like a roller coaster on tap.
Yeah.
Without the loop-de-loops. But it's the pinning to your seat, it seems like you're not supposed to be able to experience that from some sort of a consumer vehicle that you can just a regular person could buy if you have the money. It seems too crazy. And then the idea that this Roadster is a half of a second faster than that.
Yeah.
That's madness.
Well, with the Roadster, we're going to do some things that are kind of unfair. So we're going to take some things from from Rocket World and put them on a car. So.
Oh, I read about that. Yeah. Explain that. Like, what do you do?
Well, like I said, we can't do the product unveil right here, but it's going to do some things that are unfair.
And unfair.
When we do the unveil of the Roadster, let me just say that anyone who's been waiting, they won't be sorry. They won't be sorry.
Oh, sure. Well, anything that goes 0 to 60, what is it, 1.9? Is that the 0 to 60?
That's the base model.
That's What's the top of the food chain model?
Well, I guess
okay. Faster than that. Let's just say faster than that.
Yeah.
That seems so crazy to me. Now, what was it like when the dude threw the steel balls at the window and they were supposed to not break and it broke?
Well, yeah, I mean,
I know extenuating circumstances.
You know that our demos are authentic. So I was not expecting that, and then I think I muttered under my breath, like, holy shit.
Yeah. You didn't get mad, though.
No.
You didn't Steve Jobs it.
No, I definitely swore, but you know, I didn't think the mic would pick it up, but it did. So we practiced this, you know, behind the scenes.
Yeah.
At Tesla, we don't do tons of practice for our demos because we're working on the cars. Like, we're building new technologies and improving the fundamental product. So we're not spending it like doing like hundreds of, you know, practice things or anything like that. We don't have time for that. But just hours before the demo, both Franz, is head of design and I were in the studio throwing steel balls at the window and just bouncing right off. I'm like, okay, this seems pretty good. Seems like we got it, okay? We think what happened was that when Franz hit the door with the sledgehammer, you know, this is exoskeleton, you know, high strength, hardened steel. You can literally wind up with a sledgehammer, you know, full on, double handed sledgehammer, and hit the door, and there's not even a dent. It's cool. But we think that that cracked the corner of the glass at the bottom. And then once you crack the corner of the glass, it's game over. So then when you threw the ball, that's what cracked the glass.
So in
but
hindsight,
it didn't go through, though.
It didn't go through. That's true. It didn't shatter the whole thing like a regular window would either, which would just dissolve, right? So in hindsight, the ball should have been first, sledgehammer second.
Yeah.
You live, you learn.
Yeah, exactly.
Listen, man, we've taken up a lot of your time. You had a child recently.
It's
amazing that you had the time to come down here, and I really appreciate that. I appreciate everything you do, man. I'm glad you're out there, and I really appreciate you coming down here and sharing your perspective.
Well, I think you got a great show. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. My pleasure. All right. Elon Musk, ladies and gentlemen, good night.
All right, that should get a little play.